items up for review at pacifica.org. You are welcome to share comments with the National Board at pnb@pacifica.org. KPFT, Houston.
Not-for-profit media for social and economic justice. Online at houston.indymedia.org.
Hey, Houston, thank you as always, whether you're a first-time or long-time listener, for kicking off your weekend with us here at the Houston Indie Media Show. Tonight, we will have Michelle Colon from the Pink House to talk about some recent events. And, of course, listeners may or may not be aware, the Pink House is the last and only abortion provider in the state of Mississippi. They recently won a Fifth Circuit Court appeal in which they were able to stay open after the state attempted to shut them down. That being said, that garnered them a lot of national attention, and with that, some unwanted attention from some local anti-choice and extreme hate groups. But first, Nick Cooper recently sat down with Councilmember C.O. Bradford for a wide-ranging interview. Tonight, we will bring you the second portion of that interview, this time focusing on the topic of problems in the Houston governance model.
What is the legacy that you want to leave for Houston in terms of the balance of power here?
We really do need to focus more on Houston's local governance model. And I have tried more so than anybody else, anyone else around the council table, to get us talking about charter changes. We have today a complete, absolute neglect in infrastructure in this city for decades. We have the level of debt that we have today. And we have pension issues today, in Bradford's view, because of our local governance model. There's a nexus between that infrastructure neglect and the governance model we use here in the city of Houston. So I've started a very serious discussion about council members' ability to become involved in the legislative process. It has been said by one of my colleagues that the city of Houston City Council is the only legislative body in America, probably, that cannot initiate legislation. But we are a legislative body. That's nonsensical. So it just makes sense to me that city council members, particularly district council members, they are the most connected to the citizens and the communities. They are held to the greatest level of accountability, but they have zero resources. They have zero authority when it comes to dealing with those issues in their particular districts. As a council person, I'm at large. I have zero budget to deal with any issue that's brought to my attention. I have zero authority to act on any issue that's brought to my attention because the charter prohibits council members from instructing department directors. In other words, I cannot call up and get the solid waste director to do anything. I cannot call up and get the public works director to do anything. I can call up and make a passionate plea. I can get on my left knee and pray during daytime. I can drop on my right knee and pray during nighttime, asking them to do something. But they're not required to do it. And I think that's simply, it's wrong, and it doesn't fit our city from an operational standpoint the way it should.
So this is referred to generally as a strong mayor model. Is that something that other cities have, but not as an extreme of a form as Houston does?
No, Houston is the only city of any size in America that I'm aware that has this form of government where the mayor exclusively controls what goes on the agenda for action. City council can only act through the agenda. And if the mayor controls the agenda exclusively, then actually it's the mayor that's controlling what happens in the city of Houston and what does not happen in the city of Houston. We're focusing on what each individual mayor has as his or her priority, and it changes every few years, and the whole plan shifts every time a new mayor comes to office. It's almost a start to zero, and the city suffers.
These suggestions that it's important for council members to be able to put things on the agenda, the mayor has responded to the media that that would somehow constitute a violation of the Open Meetings Act. Now, maybe you can clarify that or give your response to it. It seems to me that she's saying if you ask her to put something on the agenda, there's no secret meeting that's gone there. You've just asked her. But if a couple council members get together and decide something together, it implies that there was a meeting that somehow wasn't open.
So Dallas currently permits 5 council members presenting items to the mayor, and the mayor must post those items on the agenda. So how is it 5 council members in Dallas can do it and doesn't violate the Open Meetings Act? But if we were to do it in Houston, it's a violation. I'll say that simply isn't the case.
Getting back to kind of how stuff moves through city council, Houston city elections are nonpartisan, but there seems to me to be partisan aspects of what's going on behind the scenes. Can you explain how that dynamic works?
You know, I am a lifelong Democrat. You can go back and look at my primary voting record, and I'm a D voter. But if you look at how I vote on many issues here at City Hall, and you didn't know that I'm a lifelong Democrat, you would say, wait a minute, some of the things that this guy say in some of his vote look like he may be RRRR. Well, that's because I haven't experienced at City Hall that we play a DR game here.
In the vote for the anti-food sharing ordinance, Wanda Adams was behind it, was going to vote for it. She's a Democrat. And it was the speculation by quite a few people that I talked to that it was her future in the Democratic Party and the pressure the mayor was able to bring on her because of that that changed her vote at the last minute to being in favor of the anti-food sharing ordinance. And then if you looked at the vote, it was very much along, you know, partisan lines with the Democrats voting for it, along with the mayor, with the exception of yourself, and the Republicans voting against it. Since you are the exception, the person who ostensibly voted against the party line to the extent that one existed on it, it seems like it puts you in a unique position to answer the question.
Wrong is wrong, doesn't matter who does it. And I didn't come to City Hall just yesterday or last week, and I didn't come here to just roll with the issue because somebody or issue or party asked me to do that. That isn't rapid, I'm sorry. I rolled under my own brand, and I tried my very best to read the information, talk to constituents, stakeholder group representatives, and do what is best for the city of Houston. I try my best to do that. Now, having said that, let's take Councilmember Adams out of the picture and let me answer the question. It is true here at City Hall that council members, when we get in our last terms, we start looking at what are we going to do next. Now, the next thing that we do is going to have to be partisan. You're going to have to run as a Democrat on some ticket or a Republican on some ticket. It is true that council members start to align themselves more so with party principles and values and issues the last time around because they do want the blessing of the party, whether it's Republican Party or Democrat Party. Now, there are few people who simply don't do that. This is one of them. I try my best to do what's right as I see it based on my education, my training, my values, with input and deference to what citizens and what's best for the city of Houston. That's what I try to do. And there's a few other council members who try to do that too. But Nick, for the most part, what you have indicated is what prevails here at city council when council members and mayors get in their last term.
And once again, that was our own Nick Cooper with an interview regarding Houston's system of governance. And we will, in a brief moment, have Michelle Colon on the air. For those of you that don't know, she's been with us before. She is an escort at the Jackson Women's Health Organization, also known as the Pink House.
And that's in Jackson,
Mississippi. In Mississippi, the last abortion provider in that state. Michelle, are you there?
I am.
Thank you so much for being with us once again this evening. And since the ruling of the Fifth Circuit that has allowed you to remain open, and now that you are the only clinic in Mississippi, you've gotten a good bit of national attention as a result. But this has also brought the attention from an increasing number of extreme anti-choice groups. Can you tell about some of the recent protests and vandalism that have happened at your clinic?
Yes, a little over 2 weeks ago, early Monday morning, between 12:45 a.m. and 1:30 a.m., an individual came onto the property, and all of this coincided with three anti-abortion group converging in Jackson, which were Operation Save America, survivors of the abortion holocaust led by Jeff Weiss, and also Abolish Human Abortion. So this individual came on the property and destroyed two security cameras. But before he could destroy the cameras, we saw that him coming on the property and attempting to destroy one camera first, and jumping a fenced area where our generator and electrical box component is secured. The intention of the individual was indeed to destroy the generator, which is part of a trap law that the state mandates that the clinic has in order to operate, and also to knock out wires to destroy power. I believe their intention was to put us out of business. If we had no power, we would not have been able to open. Also following that week, there was a large disturbance by Operation Save America, or OSA, and AHA, which is Abolish Human Abortion, as they disrupted and disrespected the entire city of Jackson and our neighborhood, which is Fondren, the neighborhood is called Fondren, during a fundraiser called the Zippity Doodah Parade. This is a fundraiser that has raised millions of dollars over the years for the state's only children's hospital, that's Jackson's Children's Hospital, which serves the majority of all of the children in the state, and many of which are poor children. And then to wrap all that up, if that wasn't enough, they protested outside of a Methodist church, just like they would in front of an abortion clinic, with their signs, their fetal corn signs, with their yelling and screaming at parishioners. And it was all caught on tape by various church attendees and the preacher of that church. And one of the young men with one of the groups actually told the man, and the man said, "Sir, you know, please don't act this way. We're trying to have service on Palm Sunday." This anti-abortionist activist said, and I quote, "You don't deserve to have church on Palm Sunday." So, yeah, this went beyond just the protesting of the clinic. They attempted to terrorize, and they did terrorize our entire neighborhood and other parts of the city of Jackson and surrounding areas.
Can you pontificate at all as to why? I'm just trying to get my brain around why they would target a Methodist church.
Well, one of the groups, well, what it is that pretty much they call those Christians who don't follow their doctrine, who don't participate in their terrorizing efforts, quote-unquote lukewarm Christians. So their whole agenda was to incite a frenzy in the neighborhood where the clinic is located and calling out the entire neighborhood. The campaign was something like, you know, you shouldn't stand idly by while your quote-unquote unborn neighbors are being slaughtered. And so this church had been contacted a few weeks ago by one of the local people here in Jackson to participate in their campaign, and the church declined. And so they were targeted, I think, as a whole, because the Methodist Church as a whole has made a public stance, not so much in favor of abortion, but not also against abortion as well. So they were pretty much targeted because of that, as well as, you know, some various businesses and things like that. And basically it's just to, you know, start, you know, to get the community outraged and get them to participate in their terrorist efforts to bully the clinic and bully our staff. You know, and I've said before, Jackson Women's Health Organization, better known as the Pink House, has been in their community for 20 years. We celebrated 20 years this year. We were there in that community before a lot of the other surrounding businesses, that are currently there. So, you know, these folks who did this, their organizers, obviously didn't do his or her research and had no clue as to what they were doing in regards to protesting a fundraising event for the Only Children's Hospital and, you know, attacking some of the neighboring businesses. And, you know, it's just totally disrespectful to go after. I mean, how can you call yourself a Christian? They're supposed to be Christians. They're identifying as Christians and supposed to be spreading the quote-unquote gospel when their whole message was about. It was about abortion. It was anti-abortion rhetoric. And you go to another institution, another religious institution, a Christian institution, and you attack these people on Sunday morning. I think it was very disrespectful, and I'm not even a Christian.
And in terms of these ongoing demonstrations against the Jackson Women's Health Organization, otherwise known as the Pink House, do those of you that escort women who are looking for services, is there any sort of a buffer zone to protect you and the women that are attempting to get reproductive health care?
We don't have a buffer zone in our city, but the way that our clinic is situated and the way the property is built and the way they're trained, you know, in incoming and outgoing traffic, once the women get on our property, they are very much safe. The big threat comes as far as, like, when our parking lot fills up and we have to direct patients to park elsewhere. And from that point on, when they're not on the property, of course, there's always a threat of harassment and, you know, the berating, you know, statements and, the same old, don't kill your baby, things like that. But you know what? These attacks and all of the ruckus that they caused in the city over the weekend, this past week, it actually has strengthened our community. Women from Mississippi and the surrounding states were not impeded at all. They still came and sought the reproductive services that they wanted at the Pink House, and those services were not interrupted. Everyone from staff to the clinic to the doctors to the base patients, everyone is indeed safe. This attack and their behavior did not in any way shatter our resolve. If anything, it has made us even stronger than what we were. Yeah, it was a jolt. It was a jolt. It angered some of us. It did frighten some of the staff. But you know what? Like a family does when a family is threatened. We came together. We were stronger than ever. So many organizations and so many individuals really came out in droves to help us. The feminist majority went into overdrive. We made the necessary repairs, paid for the necessary repairs. The staff, including myself and some of the other escorts, we took it upon ourselves to conduct 24-hour surveillance. We refused to be bullied by anyone. That clinic is indeed a refuge. That clinic provides wonderful services for women in not only Mississippi, but Alabama, Florida, Louisiana, Arkansas, and Tennessee. And we refuse to let anyone, be it someone locally or anyone from out of town, scare us, intimidate us, vandalize our property, and get away with it in any way to stop us from helping the women who need us.
Now, have you had support from local law enforcement in terms of also maintaining that safety that's so important?
We have. Local law enforcement has been wonderful. Earlier that week, we had just conducted a briefing, a legal briefing, with all law enforcement, with the FBI. We had, the U.S. Marshals there. We had our local Jackson Police Department. We had the U.S. District Attorney's Office there. So we had just done a briefing, educating the police about, the people who were coming into town. And so they've been wonderful. They really, really have. Our local police officers have been wonderful. The precinct that we're in, the precinct four, where the clinic is located, those officers have been fabulous. They were working overtime, not only for the festivities of that weekend, but also coming around, doing checks and watching the clinic and checking on us and things like that. So we have gotten a lot of support from our local law enforcement.
And just to clarify, it's my understanding from what you had responded earlier, you are not seeing these protests or these activities negatively affecting at all the number of women who are coming to your clinic in comparison to before all of this started or in comparison to years past. Is that correct?
Not at all. As a matter of fact, when the women come, that's one of the things that they will discuss with us, or their companions will discuss with us. They will, we saw this on the news and what happened, and so we tell them what happened. We tell them how we bounced back. We reassure them that they are safe, that this clinic is safe, and that because of our quick action, and the action and support of others, that we are here today for them. And so, no, it has not. It really has not. It has been an eye-awakening experience for the patients who come. Because, you know, a lot of the patients who are coming, you know, are early 20s, you know, definitely under 30, and they're not aware of the danger and the struggle for abortion rights and how these religious fundamentalist groups have attacked clinics over the last 30 years. So it's like an educational experience. And so when they saw this on the news, and first, you know, the story broke with Rachel Maddow, and then, you know, local news picked it up, they were like, oh, my, you know, we saw this on the news, and we didn't realize this was happening. And so it kind of toughened them up. You know, we have a 24-hour waiting period. So when they came the first time, I don't think they knew, you know, they didn't know what to expect. But when they saw those folks out there, and they saw us out there, and they saw that we were there to protect them, and they saw how strong, you know, the clinic staff is, and just how much we care about not only our clinic, but how we care about them, and how we refuse to back down, it gave them strength. And you could see them when they came back, you know, on their next visit, you know, they kept up their step, their chins were up, and, you know, they even, you know, were saying things to the antis. You know, how dare you? You know, how dare you do this? You all are cowards. You all are bullies and things like that. But no, no, they have not scared not one patient, nor did they scare the staff or any of us.
And what can listeners do in terms of providing you support here in Houston?
Sure. We have a, our sister organization is wakeupmississippi.org, and that's all one word, wakeupmississippi.org. They can go to that website and make an online donation, or they can make donations in honor of the Pink House at the Feminist Majority Foundation's Clinic Access Project or the Center for Reproductive Rights. We've gotten so much support from other groups like the Clinic Vest Project out of Chicago, Illinois, and from clinic escorts and independent clinics all over the country. And we really, really support that, because when an attack on one clinic occurs, it's not just that individual clinic. It sends a shockwave to providers all over this country. So when we were attacked, that meant that the clinics in the surrounding area were attacked, and clinics in California were attacked. So that, you know, it's like an alarm. So we are extremely grateful to all of the Pink House supporters, independent providers all over, and escorts, and to the various groups that I named. So if anybody wants to, yeah, if anyone would like to, you know, help us out, sending support, those three organizations, Center for Reproductive Rights, the Feminist Majority Foundation, and wakeupmississippi.org, those are the groups that, you know, please, by all means, if you would like to send a financial contribution, do so in honor of the Pink House.
Thank you so much. And as we wrap up this interview, I know I had some questions, but also I didn't know if there's anything else that you really think that listeners, be it online or here in the Houston area, need to know about the work you do or need to know about the Jackson Women's Health Organization that my questions did not lend themselves to this evening.
No, I think your questions were very thorough and you hit everything on the head. I'd also like to thank, we had escorts that came this past week from Houston. We had Bill Lambert from Houston who came to help us out for 2 days. And we also had escorts from the New Orleans, Louisiana area help us out. So, like I said, it was really, we're a tight-knit community, those of us who fight and protect abortion rights in this country, and especially those of us in the South. And I want to say thank you to Bill, Linda, and Amy for traveling to Jackson and helping us out with, you know, when we needed it. It was just great to have that support. And just want to let everybody know that, you know, we're Pink House strong, and we're not going anywhere. We've been in this community 20 years and counting, and it doesn't matter what three-letter acronym anti-abortion group comes to our state and our city. We're not going anywhere. We are going to stand our ground, and we're going to protect and defend our clinics, our staff, and our patients.
Thank you so much, Michelle. Once again, we've been speaking with Michelle Colon from the Pink House in Jackson, Mississippi. And a few announcements this evening. One of them is an event that's coming up this Tuesday. Those of you that have school-age children in the fourth or fifth grade last week just took your first round of STAR test, or the children rather took the first round of STAR test. And also there's a lot of misinformation depending on what district your children go to as far as whether or not you as a parent have the right to opt your child out of this high-stakes testing. This high-stakes testing is brought to you courtesy of Pearson, a for-profit British corporation that has very little oversight, and in fact, when they do get people to review the exams, they sign confidentiality agreements that bars them from publicly criticizing or questioning the exams. Well, the Community Voices for Public Education is going to be hosting a meeting from 7 to 8 p.m. this upcoming Tuesday. That's going to be at 619 East 11 and a half Street in the Heights. And it's going to be the focus regarding how to opt your child out. And once again, that meeting is going to be this upcoming Tuesday because we have another round of tests that's coming up at the end of April. And unless your child is in fifth or eighth grade, if you can't make that meeting, I want parents to understand. You can opt your child out by simply keeping them home for school for the dates of the exam, both the actual date of administration as well as the makeup dates. Usually it's going to be about a 3 or 4 day absence. As long as your child, all other data points points to the fact that your child is academically ready for the next grade level, and also that your child has good attendance, meaning less, 5 or less absences per 9-week grading period, then your child cannot be compelled to go to summer school and cannot be retained. But once again, if you want to hear more, turn out for the Community Voices for Public Education meeting this upcoming Tuesday, April 7th from 7 to 8 p.m. at 619 East 11th and a half Street in the Heights. You can look them up on Facebook as well for more information. That does it for tonight's show. We also, for tomorrow, there is Remembering Selena. That's at the East End Studio Gallery, and that's going to be beginning at well, it already started actually tonight at 6 p.m. and it will be going on tomorrow until 2 p.m. So those of you that would like to remember Selena, of course, this week is the 20th anniversary of her unfortunate passing, and you can go to the East End Studio Gallery for that event, and it is free and open to the public. I am Rachel, thanking everyone out there, also Jacob, our board op for the revolution, and John and Courtney, who I've had the pleasure of sharing the studio with this evening, reminding everyone out there, don't hate the media, be the media.
Peace.
Imagine hearing KPFT even when a thunderstorm has knocked out power to our transmitter. Imagine listening to your favorite KPFT programs when you're out of town. You can. You can listen online with your computer. go to kpft.org, then click on one of the Listen Live links at the very top of our homepage. We have medium and high fidelity links there for both our regular analog channel and our HD2 channel. See the links at the top of kpft.org. There's more. Imagine being able to hear any KPFT program at any time that fits your schedule. Go to archive.kpft.org and listen or download any show from the last 2 weeks. For information on subscribing to your favorite show, to download it automatically to your computer, click on the podcast help link at archive.kpft.org.